I'm Patricia Camilleri, and in this series called Talking Books, I shall be asking my guests about their personal relationship with the written word. I'm very pleased to have with me today on Talking Books, Dr. Paul Schwereb. Dr. Schwereb trained as a lawyer, but it didn't really take him very long to discover that his heart lay elsewhere, and he went to UK to take a course in librarianship. On his return to Malta, he joined the university, where he went on to become chief librarian, a post he held for about 30 years. In that time, he took the library services forward to meet the needs of a modern European institution. He retired a few years ago, but kept up his contacts with campus through some lecturing in modern theatre, on the English degree course, and on library matters, on the diploma in library studies. To speak only of his work as a librarian would be a mistake, really. It would be to miss out on a large and interesting part of his extramural activities, if we can call them that, as a theatre critic and a reviewer of books and journals. Possibly the most respected in his field, Dr. Schwereb's opinion is always appreciated, even by those who might not have always agreed with his evaluation of a performance or of a publication. A warm welcome to you, Dr. Schwereb.
Thank you very much.
Now enjoying your retirement.
Yes.
I presume that you have some more time to indulge yourself, and you can read those books that perhaps you didn't have time for before. Although I know that you've always been a very, very avid reader. I was really eager to see what you would choose to discuss today, as I know you have wide taste in reading, and was very interested to see that you chose to start off with Charlie Chaplin biography, The Great Charlie by Robert Payne.
Yes, this is a very unusual, actually, but I've had this book many, many years. In fact, I think I was a new graduate in the 50s when I bought it, but oddly enough, I never read it. And now we've moved house, and that made me take stock of all I've got. And I've realized that I've never read this book before. I said, I must do this, and I'm glad I've done so, because it's a very interesting book. It was written during Chaplin's lifetime, of course, and with his full approval. And it goes into great detail into his films, his early ones like the Keystone films, down to his later films like Monsieur Verdoux, Limelight, and so on and so forth. And however, of course, he was, I think the book was written with the approval of Chaplin, and therefore it does not go into what interests today's readers, and that is Charlie Chaplin's rather sensational love life, and his taste in younger women, shall we say, nearly girls. I think one of his wives was only 16 years old. So people who are interested in his personal life would do well to stay away from this book. On the other hand, if anybody who finds this book, and it's becoming quite rare, of course, it's no longer in print, although you can find a few copies on the market nowadays, on the internet, you can find a few books. And if you're really interested in detailed descriptions of the films and on interesting comments on the aesthetics of the films, I think I would certainly recommend this book.
Well, I was interested to see that on the cover it says 2 and 6.
Yes, yes.
So that's a bit of a giveaway as to its age.
Yes, yes. And even at that time, even 2 shillings and 6 pence were a bit too much for someone who just graduated and was trying hard to make some money out of the law courses, as I was trying to do then, and saving enough money to get married, which was a bit hazardous of me at the time, I think.
Well, certainly people, if you ask people in Europe, in the US obviously, and probably in other parts of the world, what actor represents to them in films anyway,
yes.
humour,
yes,
probably Charlie Chaplin would come to their minds.
Absolutely.
His early life was depressing in the extreme.
Yes.
This book talks about the excellence or the way he worked in his films, where he was very often the protagonist.
Oh yes, oh yes, yes. Although there's a surprising number of early films in which he's not the protagonist. Although, of course, when he appears, he's always the most striking figure there.
In terms of steal the stage.
Yes, right? Yes, yes.
What do you think it is about him that makes him sort of the comic par excellence?
I think he's the best example of the comical everyman that I know and that most people know of. You can see Robert Payne insists that he's not just the little man who's defying society, as he seems to be doing, say, in his film Modern Times. But he's, above all, he's an entertainer. But he's an entertainer because he can look at life, he can laugh even when he's in the worst situation. He's the plucky man who knows that life is like that. And he, of course, he's funny. Because of the get-up, he managed to adopt a get-up which is said to be, there are various theories. According to Robert Payne, he was basing himself on the way in which comics like Fred Karno, who preceded him and for whom he worked on the music hall, used to adopt, as well as older ones, you know, the Commedia dell'arte people. There were various aspects of it. However, whatever the origins of it, and they are controversial, as I said, he certainly managed to create something which was immediately recognizable and immediately funny. I think the best comics are like that. Even in Malta, of course, people like Charlie Thicke, for instance, he was the kind of actor who, as soon as he appeared on stage, produced a titter, if not a downright laugh in the audience, because there was something in the way in which he behaved and looked that attracted this kind of attitude. And, of course, Charlie Chaplin is like that. And you must remember, of course, that for the first, I don't know, he started playing in films, I think, in 1913, if I'm not mistaken. And it was not until the 1930s that he started appearing in sound films. So it all depended on what he did and on his expressions. So his makeup was important. It was usually a white deadpan makeup with this famous brush moustache, which he adopted, and which seems to have infected Adolf Hitler, of course. And, of course, Adolf Hitler was the man of whom he made so much fun in his great film, The Great Dictator, in the late 1930s.
He has this slightly pathetic look.
Yes.
And that's very much the clown kind of idea.
The
funny, sad.
Yes, yes, that's right.
Syndrome, really.
Yes, yes. You find that even in the common clowns in the circus. But he was special because, he had his eyes, and the glowing black eyes are so expressive, and the timing, of course, is beautiful. The timing of his expressions when something atrocious has happened to him, or he is devising something diabolical, because he's a very mischievous character, and that is why people loved him, because he was never at a loss when he was in a tough situation. He always knew how to get out of it.
He took slapstick to a sort of a very high level, really, didn't he?
He certainly did, yes, because although he started off with the crude slapstick of the custard pie throwing in his early films, yet he went on then to to tremendous heights in his later films, in his long feature films. And, of course, in his earlier films were on the short side. The first films were the Keystone Company, with the famous Keystone Cone Cops, a huge mass of policemen who are always rushing around vainly trying to catch him or somebody else. But later on, he saw that in life slapstick does exist, and he shows it in an exaggerated form, as you have to do in most forms of art. You have to make it a bit larger than life to make it funny, and to show how he was affected or not affected by it.
Some of the things that I see on his films, I say to myself, my goodness, we're talking about the 20s. We're not talking technology here. We're talking editing by clipping and sticking together.
Yes.
And yet some of the effects that he manages to get on the films are really technologically very, very clever.
Yes, yes.
How did he manage that? Does Robert Payne explain that at all?
No, he doesn't go all that much into the technique. It's more on the aesthetic effects, but the actual technique of the making of the films, I don't think he goes into that. Robert Payne is a bit of a philosopher. I think he might even be a Catholic. The ideas he moots, the references to Catholicism, make me think that he must have been a Catholic. But he was more interested in the philosophical religious side, of course, I must remind our listeners that Chaplin was not a religious man at all. He was a non-believer. Some people said he was Jewish. He refused that at that time. Of course, in the 20s and 30s, being Jewish was still something which could be a bit dangerous, and with Hitler especially. And in fact, Hitler features, as perhaps I've already said, in The Great Dictator, where Charlie Chaplin plays a little Jewish barber. He was actually Jewish in the film, and by some stroke of luck or misadventure, he ends up, he resembles Hitler, whom he calls it. I forget the exact name, and it's a parody of the name Adolf Hitler, and he ends up being thought of as Hitler himself, and we see him meeting somebody who's very clearly Mussolini, and he plays around with a big balloon in the shape of the world, which he wants to control completely. And in one great sequence, he ends up climbing curtains. And he, at the end, of course, as this pseudo Hitler, he makes a plea for peace and security of the world. This was the 1930s, before actually war broke out. Although I think he did produce to another couple of versions of the film. There are about three different versions of it with different endings. However, there he is playing a Jew, but probably because the Jews were obviously the principal victims of Nazism. But he himself never claimed he was Jewish.
He was quite happy because he had either a grandmother or quite a close relative who was half gypsy.
Half gypsy.
He was
well,
the
gypsies, of course, were also victims of Hitler, weren't
That's
they?
True.
Yes, yes, yes.
He came from an extremely poor, we would say nowadays, disadvantaged background,
which
presumably informed his political approach, his political opinions.
Yes, yes.
He was interested in social issues, it seems.
Yes, films. Definitely. He was definitely left-wing in his ideas. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why he became unpopular in the United States in later years. And not just because of that, but also because of his personal life as well. But I think that his left-wing ideas in the 60s wouldn't have made him popular at all. He died in 1977, didn't he? By which time I think the great hostility in the United States towards anything left-wing had started abating, but it was still strong enough. He was certainly... He never went back to the United States except for one brief visit for some kind of award he was given. So he stayed away.
Mm. He was actually, in the end, they were going to knight him several times over the years.
Yes,
and then
eventually,
when things had cleared, they actually did knight him, didn't they?
Yes. I think his knighthood does appear in some of the biographies for sure.
Because he is very much... An American, in inverted commas, actor, because it's so sort of U.S. oriented as well. But he himself, of course, was
very British.
Was very British.
Absolutely. Like, of course, another famous comic, Stanley Laurel. He was British.
The fact that he was British,
yes.
Do you think that affected the type of humor that he was trying to put across? Do you think that... humor travels well, or are there cultural differences that are insurmountable?
There are certainly cultural differences. I know that what is easily funny in Malta might not make people laugh at all in Britain or in Hungary, you know. Whereas Charlie Chaplin's humor managed to transcend all these frontiers, these cultural frontiers, and he became, a byword. And there were all over the place people started writing poetry, verse. I remember a Maltese said just a few words from my early days. Charlie Chaplin, Kina Dei min strada reali fossi inglesi o italiani. You know, and in this book, Robert Payne certainly quotes similar poems, some of them pretty crude, of course, but he became a byword. Charlie Chaplin, he was somebody who you could refer to easily, knowing that everybody would understand what you were going to refer to. He was a kind of touchstone for war.
Presumably, one of the reasons for this kind of universal popularity is the fact that he is the king of silent movies.
Yes, that's true, yes.
Because you're taking language out of the humour.
Yes.
Very doesn't matter whether he's...
I think that is probably quite correct. And in fact, I think most people remember him for his silent movies more than for his later films. In fact, some people don't like very much late films, like especially his last film, Limelight, in which, as Robert Payne says, we see him killing himself off as a clown and making way for Claire Bloom, the dancer, who is the love of this little clown who is Charlie. It is the death, I think he was really declaring, I have now finished my career. Perhaps my kind of clowning is no longer fashionable.
In fact, I believe that he produced two films after the silent movie had sort of gone out and sound had come in.
Yes.
And that he tried to use some sound in it by using radios turned on and the sort of thing. I forget what the films were called.
I think City Lights is one of those films with this blind girl with whom he falls in love and he becomes her slave, trying to do all sorts of menial work in order to get her money for an operation. And then at the end we see that she has been operated upon and she can see. But when Charlie comes along and tries, she becomes a flower seller and tries to buy flowers for her, she doesn't recognize him. Although when she touches his hand, then she realizes who he is. But of course, she's not the, she's not going to be the great love of his life. As usual, the film has a pathetic ending. He's never very happy. On the other hand, he's very plucky, and he can laugh and go on to the next adventure after that.
Yes, that sort of pathetic approach reminds me a bit of Alberto Sordi.
Yes,
in
yes.
his early sort of the films where he plays that
kind of.
So immediately he has that expression on his face, and you just you can't but feel sorry for him.
Yes.
And he's really
absolutely yes.
Farce is popular here in Malta. You mentioned Charles Thake before.
Yes.
And I think if I'm watching Maltese theatre, with no offence to anybody's theatre, I'm no expert at all, but I think the farce is something that really comes across well and is terribly popular. Why do you think that is so?
I think farce is funny because it reduces human life to a minimum both psychologically and action-wise. You know, in farce you get characters who are two-dimensional, who have one basic characteristic, which is usually an absurd one, and the things that happen to them are reduced to the minimum. If there's a husband and wife, and the husband is being unfaithful to the wife, then all that happens in the play or in the film is that he's trying to get his mistress, to see his mistress, and his wife accidentally finds out, and that's all that happens. The rest of life is simply cancelled out, and this is what makes us laugh, because we are allowed to focus on what is absurd in life, and we know that we all have absurd things in our lives, and if we are allowed to laugh at them, then that is good, even therapeutically.
Yes, I think that's a very good analysis. You've lived your life with books permanently around you, obviously in your work, where books have been your profession.
Yes,
there's not much you don't know about them, their production and their value level.
And I'm glad to see that the book hasn't disappeared yet, although its death has been announced for decades now.
Yes.
And yet more books are being published now than they ever have been.
Absolutely. I think it's giving it a boost rather than anything else, this digital revolution. And obviously at home you have this collection, which I know you've been having trouble fitting in your new place.
Yes.
What about the kind of books that you would pick up? I mean, obviously you picked up this one, perhaps because you found it on your shelf by chance.
Yes, accidental. But
which genre do you go for relaxation when you're not reviewing and you're not sort of having to look at it in a professional way, or just curled up on the sofa in front of the fire?
Yes, I like a good novel, and I mean a good novel. I don't go for these pot boilers which go on and on, although I'm sorry to see that the average novel, however literary or not literary, is becoming huge. It's difficult to read a novel which is under 400 pages long, sometimes going on to 600 pages, which is enormous. But I want a novel which keeps on teaching me about people and about the human condition. Nowadays, I see that a number of authors I like Philip Roth, for instance, are writing about old age and the way in which life comes to an end, and the way in which even the last stages of life can be of interest. I am now, of course, very far from young, and therefore these are things which affect me personally. I find them amusing sometimes. They enable me to laugh at myself, and at the same time they make me think about the serious things of life. They're not exactly seaside reading, you know.
Not really. I was discussing this, I think only last week with Ivanka Luce, Julian Barnes is Nothing to Be Frightened Of, I think.
That's right, yes.
I've got the title exactly
yes,
right.
Yes,
which is exactly
read,
what
yes.
you've been
yes,
talking
yes,
about.
Yes, yes. It's becoming more and more fashionable. Now, I've just ordered Margaret Atwood's latest book, which is called The Year of the Flood, and it's a kind of sequel to her Oryx and Crake, which is a novel about the world in the not-so-distant future, in which something horrible has happened and human beings have been reduced to certain types. So it's not a cheerful kind of novel.
So it's a sequel to that?
I think so. Yeah. In fact, Oryx and Crake themselves appear as characters in this new book. So I'm looking forward to that, not because it's cheerful, but because I know that she writes well. I wish I could write, I could read a good comic novel, you know, a kind of modern
P.G. Woodhouse?
yes, or even Evelyn Waugh. Oh. You know, Evelyn Waugh, who's not as light as P.G. Woodhouse, but he can be just as funny sometimes, you know. So, but I'm finding it more and more difficult to find that kind of book, because the kind of book being written nowadays is not exactly the normal, the average, is not the kind of book I greatly enjoy.
Well, even children nowadays seem to be liking these doorstoppers, because J.K. Rowling's books are all huge.
Enormous, yes.
It surprises me that a teenager would actually have the commitment to pick up a book of that length and get to the end of it.
And very daring to books written for 14-year-olds, you know, they go into sexual relationships without pulling punches, you know, at all. So things have changed a lot. They have to. I mean, I've lived over 70 years now, and it's, you know, unsurprising that things should have changed such a lot since I was in my 20s. So
a good story is a good story, isn't it?
Yes. I love a good story. And nowadays I seem to find good stories more on the telly than on the printed page, unfortunately. I mean, on the printed page I find the good serious novel which makes me think and which I enjoy, I must say. I'm not saying I do it as a kind of medicine. Very far from it. But for sheer entertainment, I think a good detective story. Last night I was watching a Miss Marple film, you know, Agatha Christie. Excellent, beautifully
acted. Morse.
Yes. So I can more easily enjoy. It's much more difficult to find a contemporary book which can give me the kind of enjoyment with that kind of film gives me now.
Well, that's a very interesting point that you've made. Thank you very, very much, Dr. Paul Schwerer, for coming to the studio today and
My
talking
pleasure.
To us about Charlie Chaplin and others. Thank you.